Blog Talk Radio.
Reader's Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Hello and welcome to Reader's Entertainment Radio. I'm your host for this evening, Ed English. Sheila is currently at the Book Expo America in New York City, so I'm filling in for her tonight. Tonight's show will be especially great for those history buffs out there. We have with us author Adam Hochschild. Welcome, Adam.
Good to be with you, Ed.
Before we get into it, I want to let everybody know that our chat board here at blogtalkradio.com/circle-of-7 is up for anybody listening who wants to hop on the chat board and post questions or comments. We also, our phone lines are open at 646-200-4071. After the show, as always, you can download the podcast or go to readersentertainment.com and check out our blog with the linked audio. So, Adam, I just want to jump right into talking about your most recent book, and then we can come back to your writing history and where you're headed. The book that is most recently published is To End All Wars, and it's a kind of a unique perspective of World War One. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, what I was trying to do in this book was to write the history of this war somewhat differently than it has been written. You know, usually people write histories of wars as a battle between one side and another, which of course every war is. I was interested in a different kind of battle, though. In all of the countries that fought the First World War, to a greater or lesser degree, it was contentious. There was a struggle between people who saw the war as a noble and necessary crusade and those who thought it was absolute madness and who wouldn't fight, or who supported those who wouldn't fight. You know, in the United States, political figures like Eugene V. Debs and Emma Goldman were sent to jail for their opposition to the war. Debs was still in jail in 1920 when he received nearly 1 million votes for president on the socialist ticket. The great social worker, pioneer Jane Addams, also an opponent of the war. But for this book, I focused on a country where the anti-war movement was strongest, which was Great Britain. More than 20,000 men of military age refused to go into the British Army. Some of them accepted the alternative service that was offered for conscientious objectors. You know, you could drive an ambulance at the front or work in a war industry. But many people, as a matter of principle, refused to do that, and more than 6,000 went to prison. The largest group of people imprisoned for political reasons in a Western democracy up to that point in time. So wow. I was trying to tell how the war divided that society.
That's interesting. You talk about, you know, a moral drama of those critics, and you really bring to life what it was like by talking specifically about relationships in this book, almost a picture of brother against brother in some cases. Can you talk about what that was like and maybe give us a few examples?
Well, I think the specter of a war dividing a society and dividing families is something that will be familiar to any Americans of my generation who lived through the Vietnam War, which was, of course, very contentious here. Mm-hmm. It did divide many families. The First World War, there was something similar. The anti-war movement was not as widespread in Britain, but it was there, and it was something that divided families from each other. And it's through the story of those divided families that I try to evoke what it felt like to live in Britain during this time. For example, one family I looked at, the Hobhouse family, old, distinguished English family. Stephen Hobhouse was not only in jail as a conscientious objector, but he was actually in solitary confinement because he was leading a protest against prison rules. One of the rules in British prisons at that time was the rule of silence, where you were not allowed to talk to your fellow prisoners. And Stephen Hobhouse declared, "I'm going to talk to my fellow human beings when I want to." And for that, they put him in solitary. He
wow.
had three brothers in uniform. Two of them were at the front. One of those at the front was killed, but before he was killed, he actually sent a message back to their parents saying, tell Stephen not to lose heart. He knew about his brother's struggle in prison. Just to make things more complicated, a close friend of the family, whom the parents enlisted in an attempt to improve prison conditions for their son, was the Minister of War.
Wow. That's interesting.
And then I talk about a couple of other divided families as well. One of the most spectacular examples was a pair of people, a woman named Charlotte Despard, who was an outspoken pacifist, traveled up and down Britain speaking against the war. Rallies that she spoke at were often shut down by patriot mobs, you know, throwing eggs and tomatoes and so on, or closed down by the police. And she was active in all the principal radical movements of the day, went to jail 4 times in the battle for women's suffrage, strong independent supporter of independence for India. And her brother was commander-in-chief on the Western Front, General Sir John French, commander-in-chief for the first year and a half of the war. And moreover, not only did this pair have diametrically opposed political views, they were actually personally quite fond of each other, continued to see each other throughout the war. They stopped speaking to each other only when, in 1918, the British government sent him to Ireland as viceroy to suppress the nationalist uprising against British rule. She went to Ireland to work for the IRA. And at that point,
wow,
they stopped speaking.
Talk about being diametrically opposed. So what prompted you, what was your motivation in wanting to write this book?
Well, several things. I had always been fascinated by the First World War, which I think a great many people are. And it's a subject that has drawn, in recent years, so many talented novelists and filmmakers as well. There's something about this war that marks a boundary line. You know, up until 1914, you know, we think of Victorian optimism as defining how people looked at the world. Things were getting steadily better. Problems seemed to be being solved. After 1914, things turned very dark. The rise of fascism, Nazism, brutal regime in Soviet Russia, all of which was a consequence of the war. The war, you know, remade the world for the worse in every conceivable way, in addition to killing more than 9 million soldiers and some 12 to 13 million civilians. Moreover, it was a war that didn't have to happen. It was absolutely senseless. It was not fought for any great principle. All the principal countries of Europe were actually getting along rather well a few weeks before the war began, exchanging royal visits, doing a great deal of business together, joint ventures, all of this. And then through a sort of a series of accidents and, you know, aroused fears of each other, the war broke out, you know, just in the space of a few weeks. So there's something peculiarly senseless about it. And that has always made me particularly admire the people who spoke out against it, because this was not a war worth sacrificing your life in. I'm not a complete pacifist. I do believe that there's some wars that do need to be fought. You know, I'm glad the Navy SEALs went and got Osama bin Laden, for example. But the war of 1914-1918 was not worth one human life, much less millions of them. And I've always admired people who took that stand at the time, because it was hard to do in the face of this great outpouring of you know, aroused tribal feeling, patriotic propaganda on both sides.
Well, correct my history if I'm wrong. Excuse me. But the spark that set off World War One was the assassination of Kaiser Wilhelm, was it not?
Not of Kaiser Wilhelm. The assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary.
Okay, all right, I had that wrong.
And it was a peculiar chain of events. Austria-Hungary was this enormous, very creaky, archaic, multi-ethnic empire, just barely held together. And the regime that ran it in Vienna had long been wanting to attack the nation of Serbia, which was on their borders. The Austro-Hungarians had an ethnic Serb minority in their own empire, and there was a lot of ethnic Serb nationalism in the air, calls for a greater Serbia, and so the existence of the independent nation of Serbia on their border was a threat. They prepared attack plans and so forth, and then the Archduke, who was the heir to the throne, was assassinated by an ethnic Serb nationalist in Sarajevo, despite the fact that the assassin was an Austro-Hungarian citizen and that there's no evidence that the Serbian cabinet even knew about the assassination plot. The Austro-Hungarians used this as an excuse to launch their war against Serbia. But the regime was terribly disorganized. They seem to have forgotten that they had given a lot of soldiers leave to go home and help with the summer harvest. It took them about 4 weeks after the assassination to actually launch the war. And during that time, everybody sort of got into the act. You know, the Germany of Kaiser Wilhelm II, he kept urging the Austro-Hungarians on, you know, attack, attack, attack. Then France and Russia, who were on each side of Germany, got alarmed, began talking about mobilizing their troops. And a couple of things sort of accelerated this rush towards war. One was that in those days, the major powers had relatively small standing armies, but enormous numbers of reservists. However, it took several weeks to mobilize one's reserves. And if you could get a start on that process before the other guy, you had an advantage. Also, if you could attack first, that meant the fighting would be on the other side's territory, not yours. And I think these were things that helped speed Europe on that downward slope towards war.
Well, describing that the ethnic bias that was going on, it sounds like we could substitute some country names and talk about what's happened in the last 20 years.
We certainly could. I mean, I think there's a lot of similarities between the way this particular war started in 1914 and President Bush's launching of the war against Iraq. He and the people around him had long been eager to make war in Iraq. Along come the September 11th attacks. It gives them the perfect excuse, even though, so far as we know, the Iraqi regime had absolutely nothing to do with the attacks on September 11th.
So I can see where you're talking about those who were outspoken against World War One. I mean, there were a lot of people outspoken. Well, even in the last 20 years, there's somebody has been outspoken about just about every military conflict that's occurred around the world. Why do you think it's important that people grasp that aspect that you're bringing out of World War One?
Well, I think all too often when we look at history, we take for granted the things that happened, even when they were, insane and destructive. Certainly the way I was taught history in high school, I was told about the tremendous casualty toll of the First World War, how it, pointed Europe in the bad direction, made almost certain the coming of a second war, laid the ground for the basis of Nazism and so on. But I wasn't told anything about the very brave people who tried to resist this war when it was happening, refused to fight in it, supported those who refused to fight. Now, they didn't prevail. I wish they had prevailed. The world would be a better place if they had. They didn't prevail. But I still think their history deserves to be written. We can't just write the histories of social movements that succeed. We have to write about the others as well. And I guess I think of the movements to stop senseless wars, not necessarily as being something that's failed, but hasn't succeeded yet.
In your research, was there any one story that you brought into your book that you felt that touched you in a personal way, or that you had more of an interest or relation with?
Well, I was very interested in these war resistors because I had been involved in a movement against the Vietnam War here, and just well remember the kinds of choices that people made. There's one story in particular I found especially moving, and here's what it was. The book, for the reasons that I said at the beginning, focused on England. England didn't have a draft until about a year and a half into the war. Only in the spring of 1916 did they institute conscription. And at the beginning, they hadn't figured out how to deal with conscientious objectors. If somebody refused to go into the army, he was nonetheless forcibly inducted, put into uniform, and any further refusal to do anything was treated as a disobeying of orders, which of course brings very strict punishment in the military. Well, there was a group of 17 of these guys, conscientious objectors who'd been forcibly drafted against their will, who were being held in custody in an old fortress in England. And then one day an officer came and told them, said, "We're going to take you to the front in France, and your friends in Parliament and your friends outside won't be able to help you there. And if you disobey orders, you'll be shot." And these people were put on a train in custody. Train went through London. As the train went through London, one of them managed to toss a message out the window, which was found by a sympathetic railway worker, and a message saying, "We're being taken to France and we don't know what's going to happen to us." And the message went to an organization that was aiding conscientious objectors, which then went into action. But the guys on the train didn't know that anybody had gotten this message. They were taken across the English Channel, taken to an army camp in France, lined up with other soldiers. The group was told, you know, forward march. The 17 guys remained in place, didn't move. And at this point they were told, "You're disobeying orders, death penalty for this." They were put into a punishment barracks. The British government couldn't comprehend this many people acting as a matter of principle, so they singled out four of them and decided that these four were ringleaders, court-martialed them, and they were then brought in front of a large assembly of soldiers to be read the sentences, and in each case the sentence was read out, you know, "Private so-and-so is sentenced to death for disobedience." And then the officer reading the sentence made a pause and said, "Commuted to 10 years imprisonment." And what had happened was that during the time that they'd been held there, their supporters in England had feverishly lobbied, managed to get to see the Prime Minister, said to him, "You just cannot execute these people who are acting according to conscience." And the Prime Minister had reluctantly sent a message to the general at the front in command saying, "Don't shoot these people, send them back to Britain and we'll put them in prison here." But, you know, these 17 men for a period of weeks didn't know this and expected to be shot and didn't give up on their principles even though they were threatened with death. And I found that an incredibly moving story.
Yeah, that is. The fact that World War I's been over for nearly a century, and there's not, to my knowledge, a bevy of people from that era alive to tell the story. What kind of research did you do to be able to find these stories about the conscientious objectors? Because as you said, it's those people, those social movements that haven't succeeded don't normally have their stories told.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right that the survivors are pretty much all gone. The last known combat veteran of the war actually died in Australia earlier this year. And so, you know, I couldn't go and talk to people. But there's a lot of material on the record. The Imperial War Museum in London, for example, has a rich array of oral histories that have been taken, not just of soldiers, but of some of these conscientious objectors about their experiences in prison. Some of what I was just telling you about, this group of people threatened with death in France, come from those archives. I found, you know, many memoirs, letters, diaries, documents. It's always fun working from primary sources like that. One particularly rich source of documents for me was the National Archives in Britain. And the reason for this was that throughout the war, the British government watched these dissidents like hawks. They were terribly afraid that pacifism was going to infect the army. And so, you know, Scotland Yard and military intelligence and other intelligence agents, you know, agencies infiltrated people into their organizations. Sometimes they sent in agents provocateurs to try to get, you know, these people to do things for which they could be arrested. Anytime there was a public meeting, there was someone from Scotland Yard taking down in shorthand everything that was said and making a transcript of it afterwards. And periodically, Scotland Yard would raid the offices of peace groups and confiscate contents of files, letters, documents, papers sitting around. All this material is in the British National Archives, including even the reports from agents provocateurs. And some of it only became available to the public in the last few years.
It's amazing to me that they would save that and not destroy it, especially when you're talking about letters between you know, the dissidents, et cetera. You'd think that they would want to remove any trace that that movement even existed.
Well, you would think, but governments have a peculiar tendency to keep paper. I encountered the same thing many years ago, 20 years ago. I was doing a book about the legacy of Stalinism in Russia and how Russians were coming to terms with the memory of Stalin. And it's a huge, I was actually the first American journalist allowed inside a portion of the old secret police archives, then the KGB. It's amazing how much material they had from this period way back then. You know, they saved records of people's interrogations and executions and all this kind of stuff. Governments do this. There's a strong bureaucratic tendency to keep pieces of paper on hand.
That's amazing. Now that the book is out, are you getting? Have you started to receive feedback on the book? And what kind of feedback are you getting, and from whom?
Yes, I have. It's been interesting. I find several times when I've given talks about it in bookstores and libraries and so forth, people will want to show me a First World War artifact of some sort. One person brought to a talk I gave at Berkeley a framed photograph of his grandfather with his World War I Army unit. When I spoke at a library in Chicago, somebody brought me to show me his grandfather's helmet. I've met one person who was the granddaughter of a conscientious objector in the war. I was just in England last week and met one fellow, a school principal, who knew all about this period, who'd actually studied this group of pacifists for his master's dissertation. So it's been a pleasure finding that this is a war through which a lot of people have connections to in their lives.
Well, now, a little bit, you know, about you. I was reading that you actually did early work in Africa, in a social movement there. It seems like you have a rich history of being in tune or in touch with the social movements of your lifetime, and apparently now as well as the social movements in history. Can you tell us a little bit about your history and that thread of your life?
Well, certainly a great many people who grew up in the 1960s, I think, felt very affected by the political tumult in the air then. And for me, that was certainly true. There was the civil rights movement in the United States, and my then-girlfriend, now wife, and I were briefly civil rights workers in Mississippi in 1964. I also, 2 years prior to that, had spent a summer when I was in college working on an anti-apartheid newspaper in South Africa, and was very moved by what I saw of the struggle for justice there. And then, of course, like so many millions of Americans, I was faced with the question of, you know, what does one do about the Vietnam War? Is this a war I'd be willing to fight in or not? And so I was involved in the movement against the war in the late 60s and early 70s. So certainly that early parts of my life did have a great effect on me. And I think, you know, in recent years, as I've been writing more and more history, it's affected what kinds of subjects I choose to write about.
I know that you have been called upon to discuss social aspects of history. I watched a news clip of an interview you did for public television about an event that had happened in the Congo several years back and its effects now on what's going on over there and with the social changes that are happening. Is that something that you got involved with because, you know, of a personal connection or feeling, or was that something that just kind of happened?
Well, I've written a couple of books about Africa. The Mirror at Midnight, A South African Journey, is about South Africa. That came out about 20 years ago. And then more recently, King Leopold's Ghost, which is the story of the colonization of the Congo by King Leopold II of Belgium. And I do think that my interest in Africa comes from having been there when I was young. As I said, when I was a college student, I had this job working on a anti-apartheid newspaper in South Africa. And it has taken me back there as a journalist many times since. I was in the Congo a little less than 2 years ago to write some magazine pieces, and I would love to go back there at some point soon. I've always enjoyed combining both the immersion in the past that you get as a historian and the exploring the present that you get to do as a journalist. And I would like to keep on doing both things.
Now, do you find that, you know, in looking at a lot of these social struggles like apartheid and the civil rights movement and the changes that have gone on recently in the Congo, it's closer to home than people think. People think about, you know, oh, that's Africa, this is America. But the themes are really the same, aren't they?
Well, I think our country is connected in all kinds of ways with other parts of the world. The interview about the Congo you mentioned, I think, was had to do with the 50th anniversary of the death of Patrice Lumumba, who was the first democratically elected prime minister of independent Congo in 1960. And was killed in 1961 with strong encouragement from the American government of the time. So parts of the world that seem a long way off, in fact, have all kinds of connections with our government and therefore our lives, which I think we ought to know about. And writing about some of those connections is something I've long tried to do.
Well, before we go, I want to thank you for spending this time with us. Where can people find out more about you or your books or be able to contact you?
Well, if they want to contact me, they can go to the website of the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley, where I teach, and there's a thing you can click on to send an email to me. I think if they want to find more about me, they should read my books, go to a bookstore, and look for them. I've got 7 books in print. If your local bookstore doesn't have them or doesn't have all of them, raise hell and make them stock them.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening, Adam Hochschild.
Well, it was a pleasure being with you, Ed.
And I also want to thank all of our listeners, as always, for joining us here at Readers Entertainment Radio. And don't forget to stop by readersentertainment.com and leave a comment about tonight's show. I'm your host, Ed English, and thanks again for joining us on Readers Entertainment Radio. Good night.